Good morning. In the matter of State versus Damon Williams, may we please have appearances of counsel?
It's Allison Gifford, Assistant Deputy Public Defender for Mr. Williams.
Alexander Shalom from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey as a friend of the court.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jason Maggott, Special Deputy Attorney General, Acting Assistant Prosecutor from Camden County on behalf of the state.
Carol Henderson, Assistant Attorney General, amicus curiae on behalf of the Attorney General.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Gifford, please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
The prosecutor in this case committed egregious and reversible misconduct when she displayed an inflammatory photograph of Jack Nicholson's homicidal character from the horror movie The Shining and compared defendant Damon Williams to this deranged character. This was not a murder case. In fact, it was a case on the border of robbery and theft. To convict on robbery, the jury had to find that the perpetrator purposely put the bank teller in fear of immediate bodily injury while committing a theft. Mr. Williams' defense was that because the perpetrator used the words please and thank you in his note, displayed no weapons, and made no threats of violence of any kind, he did not intend to put the teller in such fear and therefore only committed a theft. In summation, when asking the jury to convict on robbery over theft, the prosecutor flashed back-to-back photographs of the perpetrator and Nicholson's character to make her argument that actions speak louder than words. The Shining photograph captures the infamous moment when Nicholson yells, "Here's Johnny," as he peers menacingly through a hole in a locked door after using an axe to chop through that door in attempts to kill his wife and child. The state and the attorney general concede that the prosecutor's behavior was inappropriate, overly dramatic, and ill-advised, but argue that it was not reversible error. However, in a case that turned on how threatening the jury found the defendant to be, the prosecutor's decision to compare him to a psychopathic axe murderer cannot be deemed harmless. As this court has repeatedly reiterated, prosecutors may strike hard blows, but not foul ones. The prosecutor's actions in this case crossed the line and interfered with Mr. Williams' fundamental right to have a jury fairly evaluate the merits of his defense. Accordingly, reversal of his conviction is required. That concludes my preliminary statement. There are two main areas that I'd like to focus on. The first is why this was misconduct, and the second is why the prejudice Mr. Williams. So the prosecutor's actions in this case violated a number of established rules governing prosecutorial behavior. I think everyone's frozen for me.
We can hear you.
We can hear you.
Oh, you can hear me.
Yes.
Okay, everyone's frozen.
Please go ahead.
I can hear you just, yeah.
Ms. Gifford, please go ahead with your argument. We can hear you.
Okay, great. So as I was saying, the prosecutor's actions here violated a number of established rules governing prosecutorial behavior. And the first is that the use of the photograph was highly inflammatory. In Blakeney, this court stated that the prosecutor's duty is to prove the state's case based on the evidence and not to play on the passions or trigger of the jury or trigger emotional flashpoints. But the use of the iconic Shining photograph served no other purpose than to trigger an emotional response in the jurors.
Second. Is it your position, Ms. Gifford, if with regard to that point exactly, that by showing the picture, the prosecution was drawing in information? Here the information was laden with emotion, as you say. That's not present in the evidence in the record before the jury. Are you going that far in your argument?
Yes, precisely, Your Honor. There was no evidence of that a weapon was used in this case, or that the perpetrator made any violent threats. And then in making her case to convict on robbery over theft, the prosecutor drew in a photograph of an axe-wielding murderer who was far more threatening and dangerous than the evidence showed the defendant to be here.
So my point exactly is, are you emphasizing the inference to be drawn, or are you making a further argument that it's actual information that is being presented as part of this record to create this emotional draw that the state wished the jury to infer from close contact menacing that would move theft over to robbery.
This was, I think, constituted information coming in from outside the record. This wasn't, this photograph wasn't in evidence. It would never have been admitted into evidence, and it had no place coming in.
May I ask just one follow-up question? Just one follow-up question, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you. In assessing the prejudicial effect of this document, the screenshot that was shown to the jury, do we assess the prejudicial effect just from the image standing alone, or do we also assess it and consider it in the context of counsel's words and remarks about the picture? So you see where I'm going?
Yes, both, Your Honor, the remarks and the picture standing alone. The most inflammatory thing that the prosecutor did here was through her words, and by through drawing this analogy that action, you have to consider words in their context. And so look at this movie, The Shining, where he says, here is Johnny, but he's on a murderous rampage. That analogy.
Ms. Gifford?
Yes.
Ms. Gifford, if I may, the photograph doesn't show an axe. It just shows, you know, it's a menacing face, but you've been talking about he had an axe, but I didn't see the movie. And so I didn't know there was an axe until you just mentioned it now, because that's just not a movie that I cared to watch. So the axe would only apply if someone had actually seen the movie and knew what it was. I'm not disputing it's a menacing, downplaying that it's a menacing face. I understand that. I didn't see any axe in the photo. I just looked again to make sure.
I understand, Your Honor. I think that's where the prosecutor's words are particularly important, because she said, if you've seen this movie, you know how his face gets through that door. So she was implying, even for those who hadn't seen the movie, that he did something very dangerous to get through that door. And she was encouraging inappropriate discussion, perhaps among the jurors, about what was the context of this photograph and what did happen before he...
You're also suggesting... I take it you're also suggesting that at least one or more jurors were familiar with this very well-known movie, and therefore what is being conveyed is more than just the photograph. It's everything that goes with that character, like you were saying, a homicidal murderer comes into play. And even if more than one juror or one or more jurors saw it, there's a decent likelihood that it may have been discussed. Those who hadn't seen it may have been asking those who had seen it, what was it all about? Is that part of your argument?
Your Honor, and we all know the saying, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and here the picture really was worth 1,000 words, given how terrifying and crazy the Nicholson character is in that movie. Mm-hmm. Continuing on to the point of prejudice that I had been speaking about earlier, this really was a case on the border of robbery and theft, and the jury's decision turned on how dangerous it found the perpetrator to be. And because the comparison here carried the risk that the jury would find the perpetrator to be more dangerous than the evidence showed, there's a clear risk of harm in this case. And this court has recognized in both Smith and Frost that prosecutorial misconduct requires reversal when it goes to the heart of the case. And that's really precisely what happened.
Go ahead, Justice Patterson. I think we were both asking the next question.
Okay. There was an offer by the trial court to give a curative instruction, and in what may have been very good strategy, the lawyer thought it would highlight it and decline that. How does that factor into the analysis?
I think what's important here is to look at the back and forth that happened between defense counsel and the judge in discussing the possibility of a curative. And the concern here on both the trial court and defense counsel's part was that a curative could actually do more harm than good in this case because of how inflammatory the comparison was. And so while my position is a curative would have been better than nothing at all, it was a reasonable concern that the curative could actually do more damage here by drawing attention to the comparison. So it doesn't show that defense counsel didn't see this as a serious issue and a serious prejudicial issue.
The appellate division called this a fleeting comment in assessing the prejudicial effect. But some academic studies suggest that words combined with pictures have greater impact in the memory of jurors than words alone. So how should this court consider assessing the harmfulness of words and pictures used in PowerPoint presentations that may stray beyond appropriateness in the future? What kind of standards should be applied?
Of course, and I think the visual aids are governed by the same law as oral statements, but anytime generally these visual aids then, as the Attorney General states, must contain or reference admissible evidence. And whether these visual aids cross a line is the type of determination that a trial court is in a very good position to decide, because it's the type of prosecutorial misconduct determination that trial courts are making on a day-to-day basis. But any time that a visual aid is utilized by the prosecutor, there needs to be particular caution about straying at all from the record, because there carries a risk of having a very inflammatory impact on jurors that take them out.
But how do we preserve well-tried cases, though, Ms. Gifford? I mean, in order to address this problem that you're describing to the court, is the only remedy sharing the PowerPoint picture ahead of time, which the state and its advocates see problems with? But if it can't be pulled back and a curative instruction won't work, I mean, do we lose the efficiency of a well-tried case because of a last-minute showing of a slide with remarks in closing statements? There's a practicality that I'm concerned about here.
We do, Your Honor, and that's why I think it's so important to adopt a rule where these slides are disclosed beforehand, because when we get so far into the trial that this was so prejudicial, the court's only remedy was to
hear
this trial at this point. And at that point, if that's going to be the situation, certainly the trial court and the attorneys want to know beforehand and be able to prevent that prejudicial imagery from getting to the jury in the first place.
But by virtue of the order of proceedings in a criminal trial, that a rule that says that everything must be disclosed ahead of time, all PowerPoint or whatever the audiovisuals are, is much harder on the state than it is on the defendant. It essentially gives the defendant the opportunity, if that disclosure is made before both summations, to respond to a summation that's coming from the state with a lot of precision. I don't understand how that could ever, if we're talking summations, I don't understand how that ever could be an equitable rule.
Well, Your Honor, one thing that I would propose, that the state could disclose these images right before its summation, at which point the defense case would be completed. So in that case, there would be no risk to the state, because the defense case has already wrapped up. And my position is I have no issue with that, those slides being disclosed right before the state's summation.
The prophylactic rule that you've suggested, showing visual aids to the judge before using them, does that apply to both sides or just to one?
My position is that it should just apply to the state, for the same reason that discovery rules aren't entirely reciprocal. The concern here is that when the jury sees prejudicial imagery, it's depriving the defendant of his constitutional right to a fair trial, where the state has the burden of proving guilt beyond reasonable doubt based on the evidence. And the proposed rule here is to prevent such imagery from depriving the defendant of that right.
So the goal at this point is to ensure a fair trial, to protect the rights of a variety of players. Of course, the defendant, a victim, and public also have rights with respect to a trial. And as all parties have pointed out, we want to avoid abuse and retrials. Why wouldn't the rule, if it were adopted, be applicable to both sides, logically?
My position is that everyone has a right to a fair trial and an interest in a fair trial, that because the defendant's rights are rooted in the Constitution, that the stakes are higher when prejudicial imagery comes in and potentially deprives the defendant of that right.
You're not giving a reason. What's the harm? You're about to give the summation. What is the harm showing what imagery you're about to introduce right before your summation, so that if it is objectionable, it could be objected to before it's flashed before the jury?
And my position, first of all, is that I would prefer a mutual disclosure rule to no rule at all, but because of the defendant's fair trial rights are rooted in the Constitution and there is a risk of, and his liberty is at stake here, that's my position, is that it shouldn't go both ways, but a mutual rule would be preferable to no rule at all in my position.
Let's pause for a second. Mr. Maggott, can you hear us? You have to unmute yourself.
I can hear you now, Your Honor. I did lose volume for a while, so I'm trying to piece together the arguments now.
All right, you'll let us know if you need more help later with respect to that. We'll go back to Ms. Gifford. Thank you. Ms. Gifford, I want to try to understand the scope of the rule as well. I've seen gifted attorneys on both sides use either a flip chart or a PowerPoint to summarize their summations in bullet points. So there's the visual and there's the oral. Are you suggesting that essentially that summary of the closing would need to be turned over as well?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the entire, to be safe that we're covering any possible prejudicial imagery, the whole PowerPoint should be disclosed right beforehand to allow
so
this, for. And I so guess this, if it, if the oh yeah yeah. Sorry, continue.
The Supreme Court of Washington in State versus Walker adopted a variant on what you're suggesting, encouraging trial judges to preview slides before they're shown to a jury, but not requiring it as a hard and fast rule. Is that a sensible approach?
It's not, in my opinion, Your Honor, for the simple reason that a rule requires compliance, whereas an encouragement doesn't require compliance. It's just a stronger action to take that would ensure that these images are not getting to the jury. Encouragement is a good first step, but a rule is a stronger and better action to take, in my opinion.
Have they had problems in Washington State, to your knowledge?
Since Walker, I'm not positive how effective the encouragement has been. I would have to look more into that.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add before we'll have you back for rebuttal?
Okay, if there are no further questions, I'd just like to sum up by quoting this court, in that the primary duty of a prosecutor is not to obtain convictions, but to see that justice is done. And in a case that turned on how dangerous the jury found the perpetrator, the prosecutor's decision to compare him to a homicidal maniac unquestionably deprived Mr. Williams of its constitutional right to a fair trial. Mr. Williams deserves a trial where the state makes the case based on the evidence alone. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shalom.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'd like to start by taking up this timing question, because I think it's an important one, if the court does impose a prophylactic rule. In my experience as a trial attorney, where I was frequently using visual aids, courts often asked for pre-inspection and to provide to my adversary as well. And the I was comfortable with that so long as it didn't give them an advance look before they were going to go. So, for example, because Justice Patterson, you're right, obviously, that the timing of summations would necessarily harm the state if it had to go before all summations. The same is true for opening statements in the inverse, which is to say if we asked a defendant to provide any visual aids prior, but if we had the defendant do it after the state had opened, but prior to the defendant's opening, there would be no prejudice. And this shouldn't be a long inspection. The other side doesn't get to say, I don't like this slide. They simply get to note where the slide is objectionable. So that's on timing. Justice Fernandez-Vina, on the question of, I think you're in a minority amongst people who are not familiar with the axe and the shining, but let's accept that.
I'm in a minority in any movie, because the last movie I watched was Gladiator about 30 years ago. I'm not a movie fan.
Fair enough. And that may well have been true of some of the 14 jurors, but the prosecutor acknowledged that and essentially invited those jurors not familiar with the film to consult with the jurors familiar with the film. And so for the non-movie buffs, it's important to know that on the other side of Jack Nicholson's face is his wife and son cowering in the room, afraid they're going to get killed by him, because he had previously killed another employee in the hotel. So this is a violent scene, and it is an iconic scene that most jurors would know, and those who didn't would be asking about it. I want to talk a little bit about the role of the curative, the non-delivered curative, because the state and the attorney general seem to suggest that, look, the reason the defendant didn't want the curative is because it would focus the jury's attention on the message that actions speak louder than words, the proper message that actions speak louder than words. That wasn't the concern, or it certainly wasn't the only concern. The concern was it would focus their attention on this implicit comparison between Mr. Williams and Mr. Torrance, the villain in the film. And that's the risk, is that you highlight that. Everyone has used the adage that a picture is worth 1,000 words, and that's true, and that's why they can be so powerful. But what the state can't do is disclaim the words that are bad for them, to say, I want to get all the power from this, but the only ones I'm explicitly endorsing are these 250, so ignore the 750 that talk about violence and fear. Because if you take the risk and the benefit of using an image, you have to accept the image as it is, and it comes with all of its warts. You know, I know that the appellate division in this case didn't simply say that the misconduct in this case didn't rise to the level of reversible misconduct. They said the conduct didn't rise to misconduct. So implicit in the appellate division's opinion is a message to prosecutors that this is okay. And obviously, even in the acknowledgement of the prosecutor and the attorney general here, they say this was not appropriate. So seemingly acknowledge that it's misconduct and ask the court to find that it's harmless. And the risk is, if we keep finding error to be harmless, we risk taking our prosecutorial misconduct jurisprudence and turning it into word soup, where we can find a quote that supports our position. Oh, listen, prosecutors are allowed to strike hard blows. And we forget the overall picture, which is they must refrain from striking foul ones. This is as foul of a blow as could have been struck. And I just ask you to take all of the language, the unsaid language from that image. Imagine if a prosecutor stood up and said, just like someone who tried to kill his wife and kids with an axe, but before didn't say, I'm going to kill you, and instead said, here's Johnny, Mr. Williams conveyed a threat. There isn't a judge in the world that would allow such prejudicial evidence in. They can't seek shelter in the fact that they used a picture rather than words to convey the same message. Unless the court has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shalom. Mr. Magan, before you start, is there anything you need additional context from? I'm sorry that you were out for a little bit of the argument earlier. And if that happens to anyone, please just wave your hand so that we'll stop it in the moment. Any additional context you need, Mr. Magan?
I believe I missed
regarding the discussion of a prophylactic rule. I came in at the end, so I believe I have a good understanding of probably where the questions were going, but I did miss that portion, I believe, primarily regarding Ms. Gifford's argument.
But Ms. Gifford, would you like to sum up your position on the prophylactic rule, and then we'll have Mr. Maggott step in and try to wrap in, if you can, some of the issues we discussed.
Yes, we talked about whether the rule would apply to both the prosecution and the defense, and about the timing of the disclosure. And my position primarily is that the rule shouldn't go both ways, because a defendant's constitutional rights to a fair trial are rooted in the Constitution, and the prejudicial imagery poses a real risk of undermining that right, though I would prefer and support a mutual disclosure rule over no rule at all. And we talked a bit about the timing of the disclosure and how it could happen right before each side goes during opening and summation in order to limit any unfair advantage to either side. For example, if the state disclosed right before it made its case in summation, the defense case would already be completed at that point. So there would be no unfair advantage to the state there. If the court wants to add anything further.
Thank you, Ms. Gifford. Very helpful. Mr. Maggott.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Gifford. Regarding those comments, the state will first begin with a discussion of whether a prophylactic rule would be necessary in this instance or in future cases. And it's the state's position that would not be necessary, that what is already in place, the rules set by this court, the guidance offered by this court in its multitude of opinions addressing prosecutorial misconduct, and clearly laying out what constitutes prosecutorial misconduct, that a prophylactic rule is not necessary. A perfect example would be in Milton versus State, the case from Texas that's been discussed in the briefs in this case. Even there, the state provided the video to the defense and to the court prior to it presenting it to the jury during the penalty phase. And even there was still an appeal, there's still an issue. So it's not a rule that's going to be perfect, that's going to always act as a dam to any possible prejudicial material getting before the jury. We're still going to end up where we are today, is that it's going to be appealed, it's going to be argued. The rules that are in place.
Why is that, Mr. Maggott? It would seem to me that if our rules were so clear, we wouldn't be arguing this appeal. If before the prosecutor's summation, the prosecutor was required to disclose the iconic Jack Nicholson homicidal maniac look, I take it there would have been an objection, and in all probability, the trial court would have said, you can't show that. And then we wouldn't be here arguing this case. So why not have this prophylactic rule?
And Your Honor is right that, yes, in this instance, that may very well have played out, that if this image was shown to the court and to counsel prior to closing, it may not have been permitted to be shown to the jury in this instance.
How about it's close, the court rules that it's inappropriate or appropriate, and it's used? The parties don't waive the right to appeal because the court's ruling whether it's admissible or not, or proper or improper, can always be appealed. So the fact that you're seeing it, just to give it to me, is just to give you an opportunity to respond to it in your summation. But that doesn't mean that you're waiving the defendant in this case is waiving their right to appeal. So in that sense, the rule wouldn't do much other than just prepare you so that you can do a better job on your response, on your summation or opening statement. But it wouldn't change anything, like Justice Alvin said. So how would it be helpful? Because I'm sure that you're not willing to say, I waive my right to an appeal for an improper video because the court ruled that it was appropriate to be used in summation. So would the rule help at all?
Correct. And the very fact that a defendant will always have that vehicle, the defendant will always have that measure of being able to appeal a decision that they believe was erroneous, that's where the fundamental right is always going to be preserved for a defendant, is that the defendant will always have that right to appeal that decision if the defendant believes it was erroneous. And back to whether the prophylactic rule would or would not work, an example to that Milton versus State case. And yes, in this case, if the prosecutor had shown the image to the court and to defense counsel prior to providing it to the jury, showing it to the jury, it may not have been permitted. But this is this instance. And if this court, with its guiding hand, were to rule that, yes, this image was inappropriate, but the state's position is that it was harmless, then in the future, that would be the guiding hand for prosecutors when it comes to closing, when it comes to providing images in a PowerPoint presentation. And a perfect example is Rivera. In Rivera, there was a PowerPoint presentation, and in that instance, the prosecutor used a piece of evidence, an image of the defendant, but put the words guilty across the forehead of the defendant. And the appellate division in that case said that that was improper. So now going forward, prosecutors know if I'm going to use a PowerPoint presentation, if I'm going to provide a slide that have come from evidence, I can't put the words guilty across the slide and offer it as my own personal opinion. I have to back up whatever I put on the slide with the evidence in the case or the reasonable inferences that may be drawn from that evidence. So
that's,
Rivera
that's
offered
the rule.
One guidance.
We understand. Can I just bring you back to a much earlier question by Justice LaVecchia? Admittedly, there are going to be challenges and questions and appeals, whether it's disclosed or not. But she raised the question of, would this not save some well-tried cases, because at least the judge, counsel and the judge would have a chance to weigh in. It's not a question of whether it's a perfect solution in every case. It's not a question of whether anybody's waiving any right. The question is whether will we be able to save some cases, because it would seem common sense would tell you you don't stand guilty across the forehead of a picture, but somebody did it. Isn't that really the question? Can we save, not hurt anybody, not prejudice anybody, not undermine a case or strategy, by simply saying before the closing, the state and defense counsel will advise the court of the visual aids and give opposing counsel a chance to object? Would that not, I guess I'm repeating myself, but would that not potentially save well-tried cases?
Respectfully, any potential that may exist is thwarted by the fact that it is too cumbersome and really, at the end of the day, too prejudicial for either party, because the defense is arguing that the defense should not have to provide a preview of its closing or of its PowerPoint slides, but the state should have to do that. That right there is unfair. Just because the defendant's entitled to a fundamentally fair
assume it's a mutual obligation.
And then if it's a mutual obligation, then it still is cumbersome in the sense of how would it functionally work at trial, in the sense of when would those images be provided? Would they be provided on the seconds before closings begin? And then if the state has an objection, everything has to stop and it has to be argued. There's no opportunity to brief the issue. There's no opportunity for the court to further investigate the issue, because now you have the jury locked and ready to hear a closing argument.
You really think you're going to have to brief this the photograph? Come on. There would be a photograph and there would be an objection, and it would be to the benefit of the state, because the state does not want to have its convictions overturned. In this particular case, the prosecutor, who was acting in an apparent excessive manner, would have been saved by the objection and the trial court. Well, that would benefit the state, no?
It would benefit the state, but also the state in this instance benefited from the fact that this was not prejudicial, that this does not, this image, the image that Your Honor just held up, in the grand scheme, this image did not rise to the level of being substantially prejudicial.
Let's come back to that in just a moment. Is there an informal practice, to your knowledge, that takes place where counsel show each other images before argument?
I'm unaware if there is any informal practice. It may occur in certain instances where, you know, either attorney may want to show something to the jury or utilize something, and they bring it to the other attorney's attention or the court's attention ahead of time. I'm unaware if there's any understanding of that nature or any informal practice. It may or may not occur. I'm unaware of it being informal.
And what would be the harm in a case like this where a photo were shown in advance to the other side? You're not giving away the entirety of your argument.
One would be the delay, clearly, because, for example, this image was part and parcel of a PowerPoint presentation that was already put together and ready to be utilized. If this image was now not permitted to be used, the prosecutor needs to be afforded the time to edit the PowerPoint, and it could significantly delay the trial. It could significantly delay the closings. When you have closings for the benefit of both parties, you want those closings to occur shoulder to shoulder. You don't want there to be a significant gap or period between the closings because it's detrimental to both parties. You want those closings to occur at the same time so that the jury is presented with the arguments of counsel together and at the same time so they can understand those arguments. If a defense...
But again, isn't a brief delay to ensure that both parties agree that whatever's being presented is appropriate, isn't a brief delay better than a conviction being reversed because of extremely prejudicial pictures or images being shown to the jury at the end of the trial? I mean, I don't understand how this would be so cumbersome and burdensome on the process, particularly in this case. If one image, the objection would have been made, I don't think it would have taken that much time to delete one picture off of a PowerPoint. Anyone who's used PowerPoint, I don't see how that would have been a significant delay prior to the closing. So I'm not understanding how this burdensome argument is working.
Well, the burdensome argument, I agree with Your Honor in the sense if you look at it in a vacuum with respect to this case and this case only, it is a more difficult argument to be made because this PowerPoint presentation was only 9 slides. However, in other instances, the PowerPoint presentation can be upwards of 30, 50, 100 slides. For example, that State versus Walker case from the state of Washington, that prosecutor presented over 250 slides in their PowerPoint presentation. That would be cumbersome if there was an objection. First and foremost, the time it would take to review 250 PowerPoint slides and the content contained therein, let alone to have an objection, to then rule on the objection, to hear arguments, and then to offer the opportunity to remedy whatever issues there are.
But judges know how to move through exhibits, you know, easily. For example, even if there's a voluminous set of exhibits, the judge flips through it, and it, you know, I can't imagine that even it. First of all, I can't imagine that anybody's going to have 100 slides on a summation. They're asking for a very bored jury. But if they have 50, a judge is going to be able to flip through them. Most of it's going to be words and the typical stuff, just to see whether there's a problem there. I don't see timing as a really significant factor.
Well, I think it even goes further, Your Honor. Are we solely focusing on the visual nature of the slides or the content as well? Because what if a prosecutor stands up there to give a closing argument and has their entire closing argument written out verbatim, and they intend on reading that closing argument verbatim to the jury, paper held in hand in front of the jury and reading that entire closing argument? Are we to say that prior to the closing argument, the prosecutors provide their written closing argument to the court?
We're talking about visuals. I don't think there's any suggestion here that the content of summations or opening statements should be revealed before the fact. I think the issue here is whether there's a PowerPoint or some other method of presenting to the jury of an image or words, summary words, a PowerPoint kind of thing. So I don't think there's any threat that judges are going to be clamoring to read summations.
And that's the very point that the state is making, is that we are focusing on it being a PowerPoint slide and not being on the content of that PowerPoint slide.
Mr. Maggot, many so-called PowerPoints are just the display of images of photographs and other pieces of evidence that are going before the jury. I mean, there would be no need for the judge to review that, provided that there was a representation by the prosecutor or the defense attorney that my PowerPoint display is going to be of photographs that have been admitted into evidence. That would be a very simple thing. Do you agree?
As a limitation as to a potential prophylactic rule?
No. Well, you're talking, the judge would not have to go through 50 photographs that have already been marked into evidence. The judge would be able to accept the representations of counsel that my PowerPoint will be of photographs that are already marked into evidence. Then the judge would be able to say, fine.
But respectfully, that would not work, because what if then you have to go a step further and say, I'm using a piece of evidence, an image that was entered into evidence and accepted into evidence by this court.
But what if the prosecutor, what if the defense attorney altered that image? What if they put wording on that image like in Rivera or like in these other cases where they put the word guilty on the image or they put some other possibly prejudicial wording on that image? So now,
wouldn't that be a false representation, counsel? If you advise the court, I used to be a trial judge, I used to be a trial attorney. If you advise the court that something is simply evidence that's already been admitted and then you altered it and then tell the judge, I think maybe some contempt or some ethics violations, perhaps. Well, just saying.
I understand that, Your Honor, but maybe I didn't understand my response clear to Justice Alvin's question. It was more that that won't minimize the cumbersome time that would take for the court to review the slides. If this prosecutor would be able to get up there and just say, I'm only using pieces of evidence that have already been admitted, that wouldn't be sufficient because the prosecutor would say, I'm using 5 pieces of evidence that have been admitted that haven't been altered, but 40 pieces I'm using have been altered, so you'll need to review those 40 pieces, but not those 5 pieces. And again, it becomes cumbersome. It's a simple
fact. Mr. Maggot, would you be opposed to a statement from this court asking or encouraging, but falling short of commanding, parties to informally exchange visual aids before argument at the end of the case and at the beginning, and encouraging the judge to intervene as necessary? Visual aids like the sort that we are looking at in this case.
I think an encouragement is far more practical and applicable than a prophylactic absolute rule. I think that would be more cumbersome. I think that would be the guiding hand necessary from this court to ensure that possible prejudicial issues do not occur in the future. And I do think that it would allow the attorneys to understand the informal process, especially if they have a good working relationship with the opposing counsel or the court. I think that would address any potential issues.
Encouragement is better because you wouldn't follow and then we'd be right back where we are today, whereas a rule you'd have to follow and then we wouldn't be here today. So we'd be sitting here today listening to this?
No, not at all. It's that simply it's difficult to come up with an exact rule to apply to these situations. All these other courts from other jurisdictions have offered encouragement. None of them have put out a prophylactic rule that specifically demands or requires. It's always been an encouragement. And even in Walker, that encouragement was based on frustration because they saw that case as an abuse. It was 200 power slides with over 100 that were improper. So even with that frustration in Walker, the court still only gave an encouragement because it's dangerous to give a prophylactic rule that's requiring something of counsel when it comes to really what is in essence their work product up until the moment they present it to the jury. It's their thoughts, it's their notes as to the case. But again, with respect to this case in particular, there was no substantial prejudice that would have gone to the defendant's fundamental rights for a fair trial in this case. Yes.
One last question before we get there, because I know you appear today as the acting county prosecutor. Did I hear that correct?
Yes, acting assistant prosecutor.
Acting assistant prosecutor. Never mind. I'll withdraw the question.
I appreciate the thought, Your Honor.
Can I ask you to focus directly on an area that's already received attention that's of concern? It's not the video. It's not the photo alone. It's the photo in the context of this statement during summation. But if you have ever seen the movie The Shining, you know how his face gets through the door. Isn't that a reference to using an axe to break down a door? And if not, what is it?
I believe it was a reference, his face through the door was a reference to the imagery of his face being through the door, the actual physical act of putting his face through the door in relation to the robbery in this case, which was the defendant essentially putting his face on top of the gate. If you look at this,
that's not the comment.
That's not how he says it.
You know how his face gets through that door. Is there any other way to understand this other than a reference to someone taking an axe to break down the door, part of the door, to get his face through there? What else could it be?
Even if it is the reference, if it is the reference to the axe, it doesn't rise to that level of being substantially prejudiced in this case. And the reason it being so is if we look at the opening of counsel, the closing of counsel, not just the state, but the defense, it was repeatedly stated that no weapons were ever present, were ever used, were ever threatened in this case. Defense counsel multiple times makes that statement to the jury.
So, Mr. Maggot, this is what I ask myself. if the state's case is so strong, why does the prosecutor have to use such a cheap gimmick in its closing? Like, why? Something that has such potential inflammatory applicability. Something as explosive as that. Like, what? If it's such, if the case is so strong for the state, like, why engaging in this type of conduct?
First and foremost, the state's position is that it's not highly inflammatory. If you look at The Shining in general is been throughout time used as parodies. That movie has parodied so many times that it's hard to keep count. For example, the exact scene at issue in this
you
case.
You think this is a parody, this case, what was done to Somacy? You really think that that was a parody?
The state's argument is not that this was a parody. What we're talking about is the state's use of this image and then the assumption or the belief of what the jury's understanding of the entire movie was. Counsel has argued that this image of Jack Torrance is a character who's a homicidal maniac. That was never referenced by the prosecutor, never referenced in the record, yet the defense is operating under what the jury understands this movie to be. And it's the state's position that what this movie is understood to be also in society today is that it is nothing more than a parody. For example, this actual scene, the scene of Here's Johnny and the Axe, was a Super Bowl commercial this past year by Mountain Dew with Bryan Cranston. They had Bryan Cranston approach the door, axe it down, stick his head through the door, and then make a comment about sugar-free Mountain Dew.
Are you suggesting that the prosecutor was using this as a joke, as a light moment? This is just a failed attempt at humor? Is that what you're suggesting?
No. What the state is suggesting is we are operating on this assumption that the jury only looks at The Shining as a horrific horror movie with a homicidal maniac. And that cannot be the case when we look at what this movie has been used, how it has been presented to the public, to culture. This movie came out 40 years ago.
But how is it being presented in this case, where the question was whether this was a robbery or a theft? I think we can all agree it wasn't being presented as a lighthearted joke. It was being presented to show that here's this homicidal maniac saying words that don't on their face seem threatening, but they are really threatening because he's a homicidal maniac. I mean, regardless of whether this movie has been used in lighthearted fashion, we are talking about how it was used here in this summation. That was clearly not the case here.
Yes, but also it's the use coupled by the jury's understanding of the movie. If the jury's understanding of the movie is that it's a horror movie, then that is one thing, but the jury also may very well have the understanding that this movie doesn't carry that weight.
That was a Mandu commercial. I get
about
it.
A fictional character.
So Mr. Maggot, on the top of the iconic photograph is "Actions speak louder than words." If I put in front of that, the prosecutor's actions speak louder than words. The prosecutor's, and this goes to Justice Pierre-Louis, it's the actions of the prosecutor in using this was to somehow make some sort of comparison to that like horrific image to the photograph in this case. Am I mistaken?
It was to simply illustrate the understanding of what actions speak louder than words mean. And it was not an invitation for a comparison to the homicidal maniac. The comparison that the prosecutor offered in this case during summations was, what if you were in a parking lot and someone approached you and got extremely close to you and demanded your wallet? That was the comparison offered by the prosecutor in this case in relation to the conduct carried out by the defendant. The image was offered as an illustration as to the understanding of what actions speak louder than words means. It was not offered, nor did it invite a comparison of the homicidal maniac to the defendant. And also, with respect to the potential prejudice, what we're talking about is a still image from a movie. But what the jury actually saw in this case, the actual movie, the actual video that the jury saw in this case, was the crime in its entirety. There is no question that the jury had to, in its mind, piece together what the crime looked like, coupled with this imagery. The jury, on multiple occasions, was presented with the actual video of the crime. So the jury saw the crime carried out in its entirety via video. So the jury was able to see the actual crime and understand how the crime occurred, without having to imagine it. So that also greatly diminishes any prejudice.
The key issue in this case is whether it comes down to robbery or theft. And I'd like you to address harmless error with a particular focus on that, not as to whether the defendant committed a crime, but harmless error with respect to robbery versus theft.
With respect to that, it's harmless because when we look at the other cases where they found it to be so prejudicial, the issue was far greater as to what was the concern. So, for example, in the State versus Rivera case where it was the bar fight, it was an issue of two divergent stories and the issue of self-defense. Or in State versus Smith, I believe that was the issue where it came down to expert testimony and the prosecutor made a clear disparaging comment about the defense's experts. Here, while the potential for the jury to understand that an axe was used to take down the door prior to him putting his head through the door, there was absolutely no dispute that no weapon was used in this case. There was no argument by either the defense, the prosecution, anyone, that the threat or the imminent fear of bodily injury was caused by the potential or the threat of a weapon. It was not.
Didn't the teller testify that she didn't know what was in his pocket? So wasn't there that element introduced to the jury that perhaps there was lurking somewhere, at least in the teller's mind, the possibility of a weapon, which could have then been brought foremost to the juror's mind when they see this face of Jack Nicholson after he had just axed and cut his way through the door. You know, you're suggesting there's no connection whatsoever, and we're not considering the fact that that was testimony presented to the jurors.
That was testimony, but again, we're talking about the image of an axe compared to what the defendant may or may not have had in his pocket. To draw a correlation there to say the jury would have thought, oh, well, he must have had some dangerous weapon in his pocket. Well, what was actually the key to the victim's testimony was the unknown. It was that this defendant, with his audacious behavior, to walk into a bank with the bank with such great security.
Isn't that exactly what the prosecutor tried to point out by saying, you don't see the axe, but you all know how he broke the door, saying you don't see the gun, but you all know he has one in his pocket. Isn't that the intent of the prosecutor's argument exactly, to convince the jury that even though they didn't see the axe, he had an axe, and even though the defendant here didn't have a gun, he probably had a gun in his pocket? Isn't that what that was about?
Not at all. That argument was never made by the state, never put forward by the state. The argument by the state put forward at trial was the defendant's conduct of walking into that bank, pressing his body up against the teller's window or that small gate, using a demand note. The focus of the case was really the please and the thank you. That saying please and thank you, being a polite criminal, is not sufficient to get you out from under a robbery charge or conviction.
So, Mr. Maggot, the question is not whether there was sufficient evidence to convict the defendant. The question is whether or not the introduction of that photograph had the capacity to tip the scales.
Correct.
That's the issue.
Correct. Yes, that is absolutely the issue. We don't look to the overwhelming weight of the evidence. We look to whether it was prejudicial, but the state's position is the weight of the evidence does go to the prejudice in the sense of there was a video of the crime. The jury got to see the video of the entire crime. They got to see still images of the crime. They heard the testimony of both tellers as to the defendant's conduct, what the defendant said. That weighed against this image of Jack Nicholson weakens any potential prejudice because the jury was made clear as to what was the issue at hand in this case. It was, do the words please and thank you ameliorate the robbery, the fear of an imminent or immediate bodily injury? Does utilizing politeness counter a robbery charge? That was the issue in this case. And that is what the state addressed, and that is what the evidence addressed. So there is not the sufficient amount of substantial prejudice to go as far as to say that the defendant did not get a fundamental right to a fair trial in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Maggin.
Thank you.
Ms. Henderson.
Good morning, Your Honors. The Attorney General's interest in this case is essentially looking at the PowerPoints being used during summations and the standards to be used in evaluating on appeal whether or not they were prejudicial or appropriate. It seems to be that all the parties agree that the standards for the PowerPoint are identical to the standards for what's said during an oral summation, in terms that it has to be based on the evidence or reasonable inferences therefrom. And as I outlined in our brief, you know, there's clear standards of where you cross the line and where you don't. In this case, we obviously the photograph was inappropriate, ill-advised, and probably dramatic. The argument itself without the photograph is appropriate, that actions speak louder than words. But then the question is, you know, the use of the photograph, did it was it unduly prejudicial and denied defendant a fair trial? Our position was that the jury, you know, was not going to compare him to a homicidal maniac. I mean, there was no one claimed that there was any gun in this case or any other weapon. So the fact that the character that was in the photograph was a homicidal maniac, nobody was claiming defendant was a homicidal maniac. In terms of a curative instruction, I think the judge simply could have said, please disregard this photograph. I don't think people had to, you know, think over how am I going to explain what the photograph means. Just say, please disregard the photograph. It's not part of the evidence. It should not be part of your deliberations. Regarding the public defender's argument that there should be a prophylactic rule, I don't think a rule is necessary at this time because there's really not a widespread problem. There's only been a few cases where this has been raised on appeal. And the only case where there's been a significant problem is this one. So I think at this point, to take a rule may be doing too much at this particular time. Certainly, I've listened to the different discussions about if we did it, what timing we should do it. And I agree, if there's any type of rule adopted, that it should be clearly applicable to both sides, that a prosecutor should not have to display it before the argument to give defense counsel a heads up on what their summation is going to be. I also think it should be limited to imagery in terms of photographs and not necessarily to, you know, the entire PowerPoint. And I think this went back to what one of the justices said, if there's representation made that all the photographs or images in the PowerPoint are evidence that was presented at trial, I don't believe there'd be a need to review it at that time. I think if it's limited to imagery that's not part of the record, which probably shouldn't be in the PowerPoint to begin with, that that if the prosecutor or defense counsel was going to put an image in that was not part of the record, that they would have to get the approval from the judge and the opposing counsel. But the majority of the PowerPoints are seemingly based on upon the evidence presented at trial, the photographs presented at trial, and I think that should be sufficient. If the court has any questions, you know, I'll take them at this time. But
questions, anyone? Ms. Henderson, was there anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that covers it. I think that, clearly, I think things have been working. I don't think there's been an abuse of PowerPoints, but I think it's something, obviously, the standards that we have for oral arguments should be applied to the PowerPoints as well, and things that are not part of the record should not be included in oral presentation any more than a PowerPoint.
Thank you. Ms. Gifford, brief rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to emphasize again that disclosure here would have prevented us from being in the very position that we are in now. And I also wanted to just touch upon the state and attorney general's argument that this wasn't prejudicial here and it was harmless error. The comparison here, it absolutely carried the risk of importing the existence of a weapon into a case where there is absolutely no evidence of such a weapon. And when the case turned on how dangerous the jury found the perpetrator to be, there was a clear risk of prejudice. And that's all. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.